Accession number 17629, Mr. David Ridley, reel 6.
Mr. Ridley, reel 6. Are there any other aspects of training which you'd like to tell me about?
To continue what I was talking about warfare. In basic training, you teach a man various principles. What he must accept that's going to happen to him, what the enemy is going to try and do to him. And if they don't listen to you and they don't apply these principles, the land of dead. And this, I would like to bring this point up. We did a river crossing in Italy, and when when we got to the other side, it was a big farmhouse. And when I went round my shop, there was one other fellow lying behind firewood. The Italians had an idea of good bundles of twigs and tie them in knots, you know, and you had these bundles lying all over the farmyard. And he was lying behind this. And I said to him, I said, we call him Robinson, this chap. I says, look, son, I says, that will not stop even the wind. I says, anybody fired around at you, it'll go straight through that. I says, look, there's a great big tree there, get behind that. And we went about 100 yards beyond that. And it wasn't through being, you know, not neglect. It was one of those unfortunate things that happened in war. A mortar landed on the roof and a great lump of salt went in his, and then right through his head, killed straight away. But he could have been killed with not applying to the rules of warfare. That's all I wanted to say there.
When they came to you, obviously they knew they were coming into a situation where ultimately they would be fighting. What was their spirits like coming to the depot for the first time?
Very high, yes, just very high.
Looking forward to meeting the Germans?
Now, whether this was laid down to the fact that they didn't know what was going to happen to them. And as I was just been explaining there, you can teach a man certain things about warfare, but the ultimate test is put him into action. And if he lasts 3 weeks, he'll live a long time.
Have you any more memories of Brandsmith Depot?
Yes, I have one here. I don't know the date, but the war was, you know, about 2 years, the end of the war. And we had an officer called Lieutenant Lamb. And he picked me and 6 men, and we had to go to Durham Jail to escort 20 internees from Durham Jail down to Lingfield Racecourse down in London. It was a horrible morning. It was pouring down with rain, man. We had a bus. And we had to pull the bus right up against the gates of Durham Jail. They wouldn't even let us in. Anyway, these 20 internees came out. We put them all into the bus. And we had to carry all that, you know, the personal belongings, the bags and cases and some of that wireless sets and all sorts. We went from there to Durham Station. There was a special train laid for us. We put them on the train. So many in a garage, so many men in the garage. We went all the way to London. From London, we had to transfer from one station to another. And I mean, during warfare, if the public sees civilians being escorted by armed troops, you know, the crowd around you, and we had quite a commotion to try and get these men onto the buses before the civilian population got anywhere near them. Anyway, we had no trouble. We got them on there. We eventually landed off at Lingfield and brought them out of this station, and it was a great big furniture wagon stand. And the Tsar of Sham says, right, all of you on, put all these 20 internees on. And then he put the tailboard up, right, off you go. I says, sir, what about the escort? Oh, he says, these don't want an escort. And he says, they're going to get released tomorrow. So all my grey hairs that I got from going from, I mean, I counted them a million times. Every time they moved, I used to count to make sure they're all there. I had great, if the authorities had turned around and said, well, these people are only going to Lingfield to get released, I would have been a little worried. Nevertheless, that the hazard of being a soldier.
What had they done?
They were just caught, unfortunately caught in this country during the war.
But they were Germans, see, right?
Well, there were some Germans, all sorts of people. Anybody that was a foreigner was put into prison during the war.
Were you promoted whilst you were at the depot?
What?
Were you promoted further whilst you were at the depot?
Yeah, I eventually rose to the rank of Land Sergeant. And I didn't volunteer for this, but I was sent for by the company commander. And I had to go and have an interview with the colonel. And there was two of us. And he said, well, we want an intelligence, the chap is going to be intelligence on at the 17th Battalion down in Folkestone, in the Folkestone area. He asked, did I want to go? Like I said, well, I was a bit fed up with the training, like, so I said, yes. And the reason why I was picked, I had better qualifications than the other fella. And I had more, you know, longer service. Not that I don't know whether I was any better than him or not, I don't know. But in fact, I can't remember who he was now. So that's how I left the depot.
Land Sergeant, that's ranked midway between Corporal and Full Sergeant.
That's right, yes.
And do you still get the three stripes?
Oh, yes, you had your three stripes.
And an increase in wage pay?
Yes, your wages right now, but not the full sergeant. that's something about wages in the army. You see, you've got to have a compulsory, if you marry, you've got to have a compulsory to your wife. You've got to pay your wife so much. When you get promoted, it's compulsory again. And I just forget now how it works, but when I was a colour sergeant, I was paying a certain amount. Now, when I went to sergeant major, it was less than what the colour sergeant was paying, which I think was incorrect. I mean, if you went up in the ranks, Nazi, your wages went up, and I think it should be doctored that way.
So you have Land Sergeant, Full Sergeant. Where does Colour Sergeant come in this hierarchy?
Well, the Colour Sergeant was an admin sergeant. You see, everything is worked in threes in the British Army. You've got three sections to a platoon. You've got three platoons to a company. You've got three companies to a battalion. You've got three battalions to a brigade. You've got three brigades to a division, and on you go. And in right from the section, you've got threes again. I forgot what you asked us there.
I was asking the difference between Land Sergeant, oh, Sergeant, and Colour Sergeant.
So when you went up in the ranks, you became a corporal. Then he became a full corporal. Then he became a platoon sergeant. And then from there, you went one way. You either went to the discipline side. You either became a sergeant major, or you became what they call a colour sergeant. And the difference between a colour sergeant was, he had three stripes, but he had a crown on the top of that. Now, to be a colour sergeant, you start to do all the admin. You paid the men, you fed them, you clothed them, and things like that. On the other side, if you went to sergeant major, well, you had to become a company sergeant major on the discipline side. You had to do all the training. In fact, you command the whole lot. I mean, if there's something went wrong on the cooking side, well, you went and sorted the colour sergeant out.
How long were you at the depot before you left it?
How long were you
there? How long were you there?
I was there nearly 3 years.
So we're talking round about what, late 42, early 43 at this moment of time?
No.
And then you moved down to 17th Battalion.
And I moved down to 17th Battalion as to be the intelligence sergeant in the battalion. That itself, I was in full marching order. I got on the train at Durham, and 8 o'clock at night, I was still on the train, and there was a conductor with blunt dark, and this is where we were talking about dialects before. I was hearing railway porters yelling out the names of the place and all that, and I couldn't understand that, what the devil they were talking about. Consequently, I missed the station. I had to get off. And this porter came along, and I said, or the conductor, whatever he was, I says, how far is Paddock? I had to get off at Paddock Wood, actually. How far is Paddock Wood away? He says, about 50 miles. I says, oh, good grief. I says, I've been travelling all day. And I says, okay, still got another 50 miles. He says, but you're 50 miles. So I got off at the next station. I went and saw the RTO, and he says, well, he says, we've got no facilities here. He says, we've got a hall. He says, you can bed down there. But he says, we've got no blankets. We've got nothing to feed you with and everything. So I just stopped in this hall. In the morning, I got myself washed and shaved and that. And I got all my equipment, and I went down to the station again. And I saw a truck with a DLI wrote on the side, and I went running after him. I said, are you from the 17th Battalion? He said, yes. I said, well, you wait here till I come back. I'm coming with you. And that's how I was transferred from there. Now, when I got to the battalion, of course, the colonel interviews and all that. And then I eventually landed off with RSM. And we got on talking about this intelligent lark, like. And he says, are you very happy with it? Like, I said, well, not really. I said, I have no idea what it entails. He says, well, look, he says, I've got a very, very good call in the intelligence, son. He says, I would like to make him up, son. And he says, I've got a vacancy for a son in a platoon, in a company. Would you like, you know, he asked me, man, he didn't tell me, didn't order me to do it. I says, yes, I says, yes, that would suit me down the boat. So I went to...
Just before we go on to that, we'll come back to that. Uh-huh. Where was the battalion?
Where was it? It was in Romney Marshes, wherever that, somewhere in Romney Marshes, in the villages of Romney Marshes.
Who was commanding it, do you recall?
I think it was Colonel Vaux. I'm not sure, though.
It had been down the south of England for some time, though, that battalion, hadn't it?
Oh, yes. It was doing coastal defences. Yes.
Was it, as you say, scattered amongst the villages in the surrounding
yes,
area?
Yes, it was something like when we first... We were called up. We were put in various villages. I don't know, the camp was ready. And that's where we were in various villages. I always remember I was in a beautiful cottage with a thatch roof. It was beautiful.
Do you remember the name of your village?
No idea.
So you went in effect to a company?
What?
You in effect went to a company. You didn't go to...
Yes, I went to a company.
Which company did
well,
you go to?
Well, I went to A Company. I simply always hit on A Company. I was A Company at the depot, I went A Company again. And this is a strange thing that happened here. I walked into the company office, and as I told you before, there was only two in the 17th Battalion that had the buttons with the Glengarry right in the centre of the nose. I walked in like that, and standing in front of the fire was Sergeant Major Rafferty. not Sergeant Rafferty, he'd been promoted and sent to the 70 million. Well, he more or less welcomed me with open arms. In fact, I was one of the blue-eyed boys in the company at the time, owing to the fact that the Sergeant Major and I served at the depot.
Who was company commander?
Oh, I can't remember who this.
What were you given a platoon or what
yes,
exactly happened to you?
Yes, I went to a platoon.
Do you remember the number of your platoon?
I can't really, but
Any of the people, the commanding officer of the platoon, do you remember his name?
Can't remember them.
So what were the duties of a platoon sergeant?
Well, you went back to basic training again. Field training, mostly. Very little drill, you didn't do much of that because there was no need for it. Guard duties, you did a lot of guard duties. And a lot of patrols, because you never know what parachutes was being dropped and all that, you know. So, but we weren't there very long. And we moved into the barracks in Folkestone. And from there, we were there nearly 2 years, doing coastal defences.
Can we look at your accommodation, etc., that was done in the past? What was it like at Folkestone in the barracks?
Well, the barracks was pretty good, but something like Bransworth. You know, you had beds and all that and that.
Were the old barracks that had been built?
No, well, I think the barracks are still there now. The only old part was there were some huts, barrack room huts, where occasionally you had to go in there, but they weren't too bad. But there was a great big barracks at Folkestone, of brick, and it wasn't sealed off. The main roads used to run through it. I mean, civilians used to walk anywhere.
And you were in this main barrack block, were you, or one of the main barrack blocks?
Yes, uh-huh. And then from there, you used to have to go down and do the coastal defences. Now, when you did coastal defences, you weren't allowed to take your clothes off. So you had to be dressed all night. And you were manned pillboxes, machine gun nests, and all the likes of searchlights. You see, to be an infantryman, I'd always brought this up. There's the Marines, paratroopers, commandos, they all get extra pay for doing this. Now, when you become an infantryman, you become all that, but you don't get any extra pay. If in action you came up against a minefield, you had to go and clear the way through. Odd times you might get the pioneers to come and do it, but very, very rarely.
So kind of jack of all trades on
the battlefield. So to be an infantryman, you were the lowest of lowest in a sense, but in actual fact you were rolling the sight skilled than a lot of other people, because you weren't just skilled in one job.
Can we look at the beach defences that you were in at that time? Presumably the beach would be mined and wide, is that right?
That's right.
And then you had your pillboxes and your defences that were making them up. Were the coast, had the people living on the coast, had they been moved?
Yeah. We've gone into houses and the meals been lying up. They were left on the table. Not all of them who moved out, but a lot of them, most of them were.
And where did you sleep when you were on this duty?
Well, you just slept in a house, you know. There'd be a house near the pillbox, and then you accommodate in that house, and that was your guard room. But it's strange to say, but this is a fact, this. We were armed with rifles at the beginning of doing coastal defences. I don't know whether the war office will gleam kindly on this, but this is a fact. We had rifles, what we call DP rifles, with rifles you couldn't fire around out of. They had no firing pins in. Or they were American or Canadian rifles. You couldn't do anything with them. And yet we had a guard room with millions and millions of rounds of ammunition. We couldn't fire a blooming shot at the beginning. Our day was spent in wiring backyards and fences and firing houses up, or digging sit trenches and putting pit props, stuck them in that looked like weapons, looked like artillery. But it was only pieces of wood. That was it to begin. And after a period of time, we did get the weapons. And when I was on about, we had to be jack of all trades, we were once enforcing in each, not in every dugout, but in not some of the dugouts, was Vickers machine guns. Well, if you haven't had any training on Vickers machine guns, you're right up the creek, because The water cooled, and if you don't cool them by water, the sharp seize up. The only thing we were taught is how to load them. And eventually, all the sergeants in the company went and complained to the sergeant major. Said, look, we're not accepting. See, we had to sign for all these weapons. We were not signed for no more Vickers machine guns because we don't know anything about them. We don't know whether they're complete or anything. He said, right, very good. Your spare time, like, you know, say in the afternoon you had 2 hours off. The 2 hours off, you do machine gun training. I'll get somebody here to train you. So we more or less pull the rope around our necks.
And the weapon situation, even in, as you say, 3 years after your enlistment, was as bad as that on that coast at that time.
It was, yeah. Not for long, mind, but it was a fact. Mind, everything was mined. In fact, when on Folkestone Pier, it used to take you nearly a quarter of an hour to walk. Yeah, and you got 5 minutes to get off that. It was all mined. But, you know, if the invasion came, they were blowing it up. You got 5 minutes. And then later on, if you weren't doing coastal training, you had to do training otherwise, you know. And they used to march, you blowing silly in the infantry. And I remember this day, we marched towards Canterbury. And we stopped and we did this game, which was, you could have done it in the backyard, actually. It was a waste of blowing time. And then they sent all the men back, and all NCOs had to get on this truck. And we went, I don't know where the place was, but it was somewhere in the Canterbury area. There was a series of railway tunnels. And in each tunnel, there was an engine and a great big 12-inch gun. Massive thing. It was a shell of, well, about 6 foot long, about that thick. And I had a look around them, like, and I said, we got on talking to the gunners, and I said, where do you fire, you know, what's your target? He said, oh, the beach is at Folkestone. I said, oh, that's kind of that. I said, we're only on the beach at Folkestone. So I don't know what would happen if the Germans had ever invaded. I suppose you would have bred.
Did you come under any enemy fire from across the channel?
We didn't, but I was there when they did.
There'd be shelling doors.
Well, I used to sit on the cliffs. I was at one time on the cliffs. See, Falkins in a valley. And then when you start climbing the White Cliffs of Dover, there's a place called Cape Relief Fern. I was stationed there for a while. Well, on and off, all over the place. But I was stationed there, and we used to sit on the cliffs on a beautiful clear day, and we'd see the puff of smoke on the French coast. Because you could see the French coast at the time. You see two or three puffs of smoke, and then about 3 minutes after that, you would hear the shells falling in Dover. Now, I didn't realise it, but they were building cross-channel guns on Cape Relief Fern. In fact, I've got a photograph of a memorial that's on where that used to be. And nobody ever warned us that they were going to fire. When they were ready to fire, they just fired them. Now, remember, I was in a bungalow at the time, only about 200 yards away. I nearly died of fright.
You mentioned patrolling because of parachute scares, etc. Did you have air activity above you from the enemy? Were they coming over and raiding
yes,
you?
Yes. As I say, we used to sit on the, you know, when we're off duty, sit on the cliffs and watch these guns firing. We also watch aerial combat, you know, and you see them coming when they were shut down, come whining down. In fact, I remember one time, all the land, all the fields in Folkestone had wood posts in to stop anybody landing. And this particular poor chap came down on a Spitfire, and he was bringing it in just nearly ready to land, and it flipped over on its back and skidded these poles. What happened to him, I don't know. But If any aircraft crashed, we were straight. We always had to go and put a guard on it because we always get surveying hunters, you know, trying to steal pieces of it.
Any aircraft brought down? Did you get involved with any of that?
Oh yes, as I say, any aircraft that came down, we had to go and put a guard on. Now I tell you that this was just like sitting at the cinema. I was stationed at Torquay at the time. I'd been on a battle course and I'd caught a skin disease, and I had to go to Torquay to this place. And the hospital was only an old house, a big house. And at the bottom of the garden, the cliff sort of went out in a peninsula. And I used to go and sit there and read. And you used to get a beautiful view of the sea and all that, and a beautiful view of Torquay. Now I knew there was a peninsula that went out from Torquay, and on that was a load of Beaufort guns. And I sat this there watching, and there was 8 Messerschmitts, one behind the other, skimming the water. And they went over the top of these Beaufort guns, and they were all passed before the Beaufort guns started to open out. They came round, I don't remember, it was a Sunday morning, this, and the bomb Torquay. And in fact, the cliff that I was sitting beside, there was a plane came along, and he dropped a bomb right down the edge of this cliff where I was sitting. Of course, by that time I was moving. But it was just like sitting in a cinema watching a bombing raid. And unfortunately, for the people at Torquay, they dropped a bomb on the Sunday school, and a lot of little kiddies was in, you know, and it Sunday school and killed them. But you did. We didn't get any activity from the sea, like in regard to ships or anything. It was only aircraft. Aircraft and shells from, but they never fired at Dover. They always used to drop them in, at Forksonar. They always used to drop them in Dover.
And we have drawn out to look for parachutists.
No, not really, no. No, parachutists was something new in those days. In fact, after a period of time, they came and started to ask the infantry, would they join the parachute regiment? They used to come and show you a film. It was a cartoon at first, and then they showed you actual jumping and training. And they tried to entice you by, you would get extra leave, you would get more money and all this. They did get some more money, right? But
how many men would be in a patrol on the beach?
Well, you took your full platoon down and you split them up. You say, well, you might have a section in each. Say you would have maybe two pillboxes to man. You had a section in each. Not actually in the pillbox. You only had, say, 2 men, man and a machine gun or a brain gun. And the rest were in a house just at the rear. And they had to keep, you know, relieve them, 2 on, 2 off, sort of. Sometimes you had a portable searchlight to operate, and they worked off a petrol engine. You had to start a petrol engine, and then you had to get, they had 2 carbons in there, and you had to bring these carbons near enough together to form a spark, and that's where you got the light from. I remember once, then every now and again, we had a cut. It wasn't Colonel Walsh at that time. I don't know. But anyway, this colonel, he used to come along and I said, look at the ships, look at all the boats, look at them landing, what are you going to do? And if you didn't swing your brain gun down and fire a burst of rounds down in the direction, he said, you were on a blowing fizzer. He used to set you little problems like that. And you had to act positive to it and all. And this particular day, he came to me, you know, they were attacking along here, getting that searchlight on. And I was dragging this blowing searchlight along. And the leads from the mortar, to the lamp itself, there were just two plugs like that. And they came out, and these leaves were jumping all over the place. So I will remember that part.